From Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. A very good Thursday morning to you. I'm your host, Randall White. When the COVID-19 pandemic first hit, California set an example for the rest of the nation in terms of stay-at-home orders, mask wearing, and, you know, flattening that curve. Then a lot of that fell apart in May and June as fears waned and restrictions were lifted. Numbers of new transmissions, hospitalizations, and deaths shot up, as we know, this summer, breaking previous records that were set in the spring. So the state, for the most part, hunkered down again and got back to social distancing. All of this back and forth has put a lot of stress on how we interact socially. Something as simple as walking down the grocery aisle or interacting with neighbors can be layered with anxiety. And it's not always pretty when people don't agree on what's appropriate and what's not. We'll hear a lot more on that later. Our big conversation today revolves around the socially awkward year we're all having because of the pandemic. And to help us set the table in terms of where we stand when it comes to friction points is the Public Policy Institute of California's Alyssa Dyckman. Welcome to Insight, Alyssa.
Good morning, Randall. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So PPIC has indeed surveyed Californians regarding how they feel about some of the state's safety measures that have been put in place to slow the spread of the coronavirus. What have you found overall?
Yeah, so our latest poll conducted in July measured public opinion about urgent issues affecting the state, including the coronavirus and mass usage. We found as the number of COVID-19 cases in California increases, our latest poll found many Californians worry about the illness and finances due to the pandemic, and most residents believe masks should be worn in public.
So they do. When you say most, is it like an overwhelming number or is it just over the 50% point?
Yeah, so we found an overwhelming majority of Californians, that's 74%, say that people in their local area should always wear masks in public to prevent the spread of coronavirus. An additional 12% say most of the time, and few, only 3%, say that people should never wear a mask in public.
Okay, I just need a second to digest that number. Only 3%. Were basically absolutely not, no masks, but the other 97% to some degree support mask wearing.
Yes, there is widespread support for mask wearing. And even when we compare this nationally to U.S. adults, we find Californians are far more likely than those adults nationwide to say you should always wear a mask.
Oh, okay. So it does vary from state to state. How about social distancing, the idea of being 6 feet away? Does PPIC look into that?
Yeah, so while we did not specifically ask about social distancing, we did ask a number of questions which reflect Californians' travel plans in the coming months. A majority of Californians, 70%, say they are not at all likely to take a public bus or transit in the next 3 months. And we also find about 2 in 3 say they're not at all likely to fly in an airplane. What we do see is that fewer sharers say they are not at all likely to take a day trip to the beach or a driving vacation, really indicating that Californians are looking into more local outdoor recreational opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Because as we know, being outdoors certainly is safer when it comes to transmission. So from the sounds of it, the study shows Californians are pretty up to speed with how this virus works.
Yeah, indeed. I think it's really important to recognize there's widespread support for wearing masks among Californians. And this is, of course, all going on while the science shows us that widespread use of face coverings could save lives and help improve the situation.
Now, this was done in July, like you said, right around the time the numbers were peaking in California. Do you have earlier studies that you can compare that to and what the sort of acceptance levels were prior to that?
Yeah, so in previous polls that we've conducted during the COVID-19 outbreak, we found majorities of Californians, when we're looking at restrictions, we found majorities say that there should be the same or more restrictions on public activity in their areas. Contrast this with about 3 in 10 that said that there should be fewer restrictions when we asked this in May. We also found in May that 58% of Californians said their greater concern was state governments lifting the restrictions on public activity too quickly, compared to 38% who reported not lifting the restrictions quickly enough was their greater concern.
That is fascinating, because in May is when that whole process of state restrictions began being lifted. And then, well, I guess we sort of saw what the results were from at least some of that. And the people of California, at least according to your poll, were wary of that, and maybe rightfully so.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, even in May, we saw that Californians, though, were divided on whether the worst of the coronavirus outbreak was behind us versus the worst is yet to come. And of course, this was back in May, and many things have evolved since then.
Right. Are you preparing to do another sampling of where Californians stand on this?
Yeah, definitely. As we head into the election, we'll be looking at polling around coronavirus and other topics.
All right. Alyssa Dyckman, Public Policy Institute of California. Thank you so much for sort of just giving us that sense of at least where we stand when it comes to the rules surrounding coronavirus safety.
Thanks so much.
So now that we know those basic ground rules, and Californians are overwhelmingly okay with them, then the etiquette of interacting should be easy, right? Well, the problem is that the ground rules are a sliding scale for many, and that complicates just about everything. Time to call on a civility consultant. So let's bring in etiquette expert Rosalinda Randall, who joins us. I believe you're in the Bay Area, right, Rosalinda?
Yes, just outside San Francisco. Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation to be on your show.
You bet. Well, great to have you here. I should mention that you do have a book that's about to be published called Keep Your Distance, Your Guide to Handling Common Dilemmas in Uncommon Times. People can start looking for that in the coming days, right?
Yes, thank you.
All right. So, Rosalinda, where do you think we struggle the most with polite interactions right now?
Social media, and then, of course, in what I've noticed in public places, like everyday public places, like the grocery store, doctor's offices. What I've noticed, and I try not to go out, I'm a new fan of Instacart now, but but the times that I do, I find that people, and this is, again, just my experience, several experiences, that people glare at you if you are not 6 feet away. However, they don't seem to be willing to participate in creating the 6 foot space. So that's what I find. I find glaring. And again, because we can't speak with our mouths or smile and let them know like, oh, I'm okay, or I'm sorry. We have to communicate a little more. And I'm finding that we're communicating even less. We're making less eye contact, and eyes are all that we have right now to communicate.
That's right.
So, you know, when people are looking down, trying to mind their own business, and I get it, it's an uncomfortable time. Sometimes they just want to get in, out. And I understand that, but we're, you know, that whole, we're in this together. It doesn't feel like it if we don't make eye contact to see if we can be of some help or courteous or considerate, or are you moving that way? Or, you know, just people are there to get done what they're going to get done. And the most common question that I've been asked recently is, do you think we're going to be a lot more polite after COVID-19 when we get back to normal?
What's your answer?
And my answer is perhaps for a little while, but if you're rude pre-COVID, it's who you are. You're going to be rude after COVID.
Interesting. Rosalinda, I was really excited about having you on the show today because I want to know, how do you handle in the most polite way what I call space invaders, the people who, when you're standing in line to get into a place that limits the number of people and you look behind you and you realize this person's 3 feet behind me. And so you mentioned the whole glare thing. I try not to be the person that does the glaring, but at the same time, I'm feeling really uncomfortable because they're, you know, essentially breathing down my neck, and that's how it transmits.
Yes. There are a few options. And again, there are so many different scenarios, but a typical one would be someone there. You just look back without the glare, friendly eyes, speak clearly through your mask, because again, we get muffled and misunderstood. And that just adds to, you know, the situation, and just say, if you don't mind, would you mind please stepping back a little bit? Or do the, you know, so many people say the we, I'm still a little concerned. I'd like a little bit more space. Mm-hmm. Now, if they don't, that's what store managers are there for. If you're really concerned versus trying to be, you know, the hero and speak for the world and try and handle the situation yourself. And also we need to take into account the body language of that person. How are they taking it? And that's where you either choose to continue and then that could escalate. Because people have different opinions about things, you know, before you know it, you're in an argument of like, well, I'm done with that. I don't care.
And then it's screaming online, right?
I do. Yes. Yes. You'll be famous and infamous in moments. So just do that. And if you're close to the checkout, it's you're next. Sometimes it's best keep your head away from that person, get your business done and get out. That's another option.
Same tips for if you see someone wearing their mask with it, you know, just under their nose. Right. Okay. It's summer, Rosalinda. So backyard socially distanced get-togethers are popular, although discouraged, and not everyone's idea of what that modifier socially distanced means is the same. So how do we navigate when we're invited over to somebody's house for one of these get-togethers?
Well, again, it depends on your perspective. Those neighbors would probably call their neighbor a snitch. That person, the snitch, would probably feel that they are doing the right thing to report them. And I had someone say, my neighbor called the police on me. Well, first, before you do get that concern, I mean, you can get concerned, but find out what the current, because as you said, it's ever-changing, current guidelines and laws for your community, your city. I was somewhere else and it varied from county to county, mm-hmm. The face mask requirement. So first find that out. Secondly, you know, call them, text them, or just knock on the fence and say, you know, I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Could you guys please move over to the side? Again, communication and asking for what you need is important, but also, are you asking just because you're just dug in your heels and I don't want anybody doing that, even if it is under 10 people and allowed? So we need to also ask ourselves, what is our point in pursuing this? And is it going to help the situation?
So what if you're invited to one of these parties and you go and food is served or you bring snacks to share? Are there rules surrounding that?
Yes, for both. If I'm invited and I choose to go, but I still want people to stay away or I don't want to eat their food or I have whatever restrictions, boundaries for myself, it's my responsibility to ask the host, will this be available? Will you have people wear masks? Blah, 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 whatever is important to me. Now, the host, if they are going to encourage or mandate their guests to come over, but hey, you wear a mask or no, we're ordering food, whatever, again, our boundaries are, to disclose them in advance, because someone shows up and they think, hey, it's a party, free for all, finally, and they're not, here's your mask, and now I have to leave or I get angry, relationships get, you know, broken over things like this. So ask and communicate for what you need. And if it isn't comfortable for you, say, I'm not ready to socialize in a setting like that. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Yeah.
Simple.
I like a judgment scenario that you lay out in the book that got me thinking about my personal own snap judgments. And that's when you see a friend of yours posting regular travel photos. And my instinct is to think, what are they doing? But you say, hold on, we may not know the whole story.
Definitely. And that happened to someone that I know. And I call it social call outs. And they said, what are you doing? You know, went on a little rant and tried to get other people. This is why we're all going to die, or, you know, whatever she needed to say. And that photo was from the year prior.
Oh.
So before you do decide to call out, and it is your right to, you know, make your comments and your statements, that's fine. We put it out there. We have to expect people to comment positively and negatively. But do check to see when that was. And the other thing is, we don't really know why someone's traveling. I knew someone that said I had to go get a medical procedure and that was the place, the only place I had to go. Mm. So they had to travel. Some people have first responder families that they need to go assist, or a job opportunity. I know we can do via Zoom, but some require to be present. And right now everyone's looking for a job, you know, so many people. So you don't know what essential travel is defined by everybody in a different way. So before you do that, just keep that in mind. You don't know why they're traveling.
Civility consultant and etiquette expert Rosalinda Randall, her forthcoming book, Keep Your Distance, Your Guide to Handling Common Dilemmas in Uncommon Times, will be out later this month. Rosalinda, thank you so much for your tips today.
Thank you, Randall. It's a pleasure.
I guarantee you that there are people that will be using them in the coming days. Okay, up next, a couple of terms are emerging in our socially complex COVID world: constructive confrontation and insinuation anxiety. We'll speak with a couple of experts who can help us understand what they mean and how to navigate them, whether you should use them at all. I'm Randall White, and you're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight right here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and our big conversation today is about the upside-down world of social interactions during the COVID-19 pandemic. Very few norms are actually in place anymore, and that has many of us on edge. Here's an interaction caught on video of how the issue over wearing a mask played out at a Costco in Florida.
You're 6 feet away from you.
You're harassing me.
I'm not harassing you. You are infecting us.
You're coming close.
Back off!
Threaten me
again! So that got tense quick. Here to help us break down how this interaction and many others we've seen in recent weeks might have played out differently, or I guess could have played out differently, is the senior program manager of the Center of Community Cohesion at the National Conflict Resolution Center, Catherine Shade. Catherine, great to have you here.
Good morning, Randall. Thank you for having me.
So your organization's whole goal is to make sure those kind of things don't happen, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. So at the National Conflict Resolution Center, what we do is we provide the resources, the training, and the expertise for people to be able to resolve conflicts.
Mm-hmm. And so I did see your organization quoted recently. Well, one was in an NPR article. Another was out of the San Diego Union Tribune, I believe. And that there's this tool known as constructive confrontation. Can you? So those things don't seem like they can go together, but help us understand that term.
Sure. So at the National Conflict Resolution Center, we believe that conflict is not only inevitable, it is a normal and natural part of life. But the first thing we would advise people to do, and, you know, just referring to that clip you just played, is before you confront anyone, you want to practice active awareness. And active awareness means thinking about your own bias and your own emotional reactions and keep those in check before you even approach someone. So you have your own particular opinion and feeling about wearing masks or not wearing masks. And stop and think about that, your own bias, before you're going to confront someone. And then secondly, we really would advise people to resist the urge to confront people in the first place.
And this could include, I'm sorry, Catherine, this could also include like online, maybe.
Oh yeah, absolutely online. And really in all walks of life, you want to think about your own implicit bias before you approach someone else. Think about why you're approaching that person, what your own, you know, biases or prejudices or opinions on the subject might be. And think about, well, that might not be theirs. And how can you have a productive conversation with them knowing that you may not be agreeing at that time?
So
you also want to resist the urge to confront people.
So
you might want to use some body language.
Oh, okay, like the glare that Rosalinda talked about in the last
You might want to use the glare if you are going down a sidewalk and someone's walking towards you and you're wearing a mask and they are not, you could step off into the street if it's safe enough to do that, or just step, you know, more than 6 feet away so that they see from your body language, you're not intending to confront them, but you're going to sort of take the high road in this case, and you're going to be the compliant person. And so you have avoided confrontation, but you still let them know what your position is.
So Catherine, let's say that we venture, maybe it's not the best choice, but we venture into the confrontation zone. And when we find ourselves in that situation, like, here we are, I'm having this conversation with this person, and it's not going well. What tools can we use to make that confrontation have the best possible outcome?
So another thing that we recommend is you respond respectfully. So now you're in the thick of things, sort of, you're feeling uncomfortable and awkward. You're wondering, is this turning into a confrontation? And what you really want to do is to listen to the other person first and acknowledge their perspective while at the same time making clear what your discomfort is, what your concern is, or if you are, say, a frontline employee or, person working in a store, in a grocery store, you're still maintaining your policy. So you might use some words in which you are encouraging that person to think outside of themselves for a moment. Mm-hmm. And that's what we call troubleshooting together. So you might say something like, for you, maybe masks don't seem right, but I have the responsibility for the safety of everyone in our store and in this space. So all of the workers and all of the customers, I am responsible for their safety. Some of these people might also have family members at home who are especially vulnerable.
All right.
And I cannot run the risk of exposing them to the virus. And that's why here everyone wears a mask. So you try to get someone to think outside of themselves, at least for a moment.
When it's going the way of that clip that we heard, and the person who was saying, I'm 6 feet away from you, sounds like they're being very calm. And mm-hmm. the other person has elevated their voice, saying they feel threatened. At that point, there's really little you could do to calm down the person that's yelling.
Well, that's true. What we say is in the history of conflict amongst people, you want to avoid trigger phrases. And the biggest one is to say, you need to calm down.
Ooh.
Because in the history of conflicts with people, saying you need to calm down has never calmed down anyone. Because right. It implies that the person that you're dealing with has lost control. And that, of course, is going to make them lose more control or become more defensive. So you might want to use a more measured tone. And we did hear that person was using a measured tone, but you want to maintain that measured tone, which is usually helpful in trying to diffuse a difficult situation. Not always, but you can only do what you can do. You
right.
can't control other people, but you can use these tools.
Catherine Shade is with the Center for Community Cohesion at the National Conflict Resolution Center in San Diego. Catherine, thank you so much for your tips.
Thank you very much, Randall.
Another term that's bubbling up given COVID-19's new social structures is something known as insinuation anxiety. Now, have you found yourself in a situation where you're uncomfortable with your, say, proximity to the people around you, friends, family, coworkers, or maybe even just somebody you're passing in public? Could be a mask situation, but you don't say anything to correct it. This could be a case of insinuation anxiety. We recently spoke with Tess Wilkinson Ryan, a professor of law and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, who is an expert in this area. And I started by asking her how that came to be her area of focus.
Insinuation anxiety is something that I have been sort of interested in and following along in my career, because usually I write about disclosures and contracts. And so when I was in graduate school, and since then I've been reading these papers about what happens when an advisor, someone who's charged with sort of a responsibility of being advisor.
Like a financial advisor.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. What happens when such a person makes a recommendation, but then also says, listen, you should know I have a conflict of interest. So maybe if you're a financial advisor, you say, listen, you should know that if you invest in the company's funds that I'm recommending, I get a percentage of that, but not the other funds that I'm not recommending. So you would think that what happens in those scenarios when somebody hears that there's a conflict of interest is that they would actually sort of take that recommendation with a grain of salt.
Yeah, right? Thinking like they're in it for the money. I'm not going to invest there.
Yeah, even if they're trying to make a good faith recommendation, this person's biased, right? I have some evidence of that now. But so there are these experiments done by psychologists. They had sort of like a pared down, like game version of this advisory relationship. And they found this really interesting perverse effect of disclosures of conflict of interest, where when the advisor says, hey, listen, you should know I have a conflict of interest, in some contexts, the advisee, the customer, was more likely to buy, to take the recommendation, to buy the product, which goes kind of the wrong way. And there's this really interesting research that suggests that the reason for this is insinuation anxiety, to get back to what you asked me about. So insinuation anxiety is the idea that people get anxious that if they don't take the recommendation in that context, that the failure to take the recommendation is like an insult. It's telling the other person, I don't trust you.
It's a sign that I do think you're trying to take advantage
exactly.
of me and just make a profit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Huh. Exactly. You have told me, you have given me reason to think that there's a trust element here, and I don't want you to feel like I think I shouldn't trust you. So now I'm actually somehow more likely to take this biased advice. Now, this is not obviously the setting that we are in right now. So the question
right.
is what would make this applicable here?
Yeah. How does it play out in the pandemic?
Well, we are in this situation where we are in this new context of interpersonal trust. And all of a sudden, these individual decisions that each of us are making bear on our relationships with each other and our ability to protect ourselves and each other. So now the one that I think of the most myself might be wearing a mask in particular contexts, or who I'm willing to hang out with in different contexts, hang out with at the park, hang out with at the beach, right? Or in a house. The worry I think that a lot of us end up having is that by protecting ourselves in a way that's sort of, visible, like with a mask, or making the move to sort of pull your mask up as you walk down the street, you are communicating to other people, I don't trust you. I don't trust that you are, healthy. Mm-hmm. I don't trust that you are taking good precautions in your life, even though you don't intend to have that be the message that you're sending. You intend to be doing something, for example, polite, right?
Right.
Sure,
for their safety,
proper distance.
As much as yours. Right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. So that's the insinuate that. So, look, we are all have a set of tough decisions to make every day right now. And I think this is just one more layer of sort of awkwardness that we experience right. with one another.
Clearly, safety is on the line. At what point does insinuation, anxiety, and safety, which one wins out? You're in your brain,
Yeah, no, I think that the challenge for most of us right now is not that we don't know how to protect ourselves when the stakes are high. It's more that we are in this sort of nonstop decision-making context. I mean, if I think about the number of times I put my mask on and off a day, it's got to be 30, right? I went outside to water the flowers. Then I thought to myself, it's a busy street. Should I put my mask on? I'll go back inside. But, we're doing this a lot, right? So the burden on individuals to make these calls, I think right now feels really high. And there's sort of a cognitive overload that we might not experience if it was sort of the kind of one-off situation that you might have experienced mm-hmm. pre-pandemic.
Yeah. Tess, is there a solution? Is there a way that we can rise above?
Well, there's sort of two. The first best answer is I don't know. With that said, there's a couple of things that I would say. One is that individuals can probably take some of the social pressure off these engagements by not couching their choices in terms of what's happening in the interaction that they're participating in. So it's not about whether or not I think that you are taking precautions and that's why I can't meet you at the playground. It's about why I am taking extra precautions right now because, for example, I need to quarantine, you know, particularly stringently right now because I'm going to visit my parents. Mm-hmm. This has the benefit of also being true in most, right? I am being really careful right now because of, you know, some external thing that you might appeal to.
Yeah.
Or because there's a rule that I'm following, right? So the other thing might be, I am now, you know, now that I'm back at work, we are really, you know, we are really required to be particularly strict even in our, you know, personal life, something like that.
Yeah, and it makes sense, and that's helpful to the other person. Then, you know, if they are thinking in their head, you know, this person doesn't find me trustworthy, thinks I'm a COVID carrier or whatever, it helps them realize, oh, well, yeah, of course, they're just being extra safe. So that makes sense, I guess.
I mean, the other thing I would say is it feels to me pretty unfair that people are in this position. I think that one of the things that a lot of people are asking for is, you know, we wouldn't have to be navigating these granular issues sort of interpersonally if there was clearer guidance. One of the things about the stay-at-home orders, which obviously have enormous impacts on all kinds of areas of our lives, including the economy, but in terms of how you navigate it sort of psychologically, it was relatively straightforward, like just stay at home, right? Whereas part of the reopening, I would say, involves way more discretion for individuals and not tons of particularly clear guidance. You know, can you go to the beach or not, right? The clearer the guidance, the easier it is. I really myself appreciate that when I go to my grocery store, there are lines on the floor for when you get for getting into the checkout line.
Yeah.
Because then it's not about me and the person in front of me having any kind of like informal sort of space negotiation backing up and being weird about it. You just stand on your line and don't think about it. And that's a real gift. Not having to think about those awkward interactions is something that sort of institutions, leadership, businesses can do for individuals.
I'm so glad your research points to that because I've said this over the years, especially when it comes to like bicycles and cars. The clearer the rules as to where everyone is supposed to be, the less conflict there is. And that would play out in the pandemic in terms of like wearing masks and protection and all that as well.
I think that's exactly right. And we are in a situation now where we are being asked to make so many decisions and judgments through the day. And they're all really harrowing. I mean, I think for anyone who's a parent right now thinking about schools reopening, right, the amount of sort of mental space that kind of dilemma takes is enormous. And so clear guidance, clear rules that you don't have to spend your time parsing and then worrying you're getting wrong is a huge help.
That's Tess Wilkinson-Ryan, a professor of law and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania, on insinuation anxiety. So check yourself in the coming days or to see if this happens to you. And see what you can do to protect yourself. Still ahead here on Insight, we're going to hear from a couple of experts from UC Davis about the lens in which you're seeing this COVID-19 social awkwardness. May differ greatly from your neighbor or coworker. I'm Randall White, and you're listening to Insight right here on CAP Radio.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White, and we're talking this morning about the social awkwardness that really come about because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Simple situations like shopping or speaking with friends can suddenly and sometimes out of nowhere be fraught with anxiety and odd interactions. Now, for this segment, we're looking at those interactions through yet another lens, and we're joined by a couple of experts. Dr. Jan Murray Garcia is an associate clinical professor at the UC Davis Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing. One of her specialties, race-related conflict resolution. Doctor, great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and joining the doctor is professor of psychology at the UC Davis Center for Mind and Brain, Jeffrey Sherman. He's been listening to today's show and is here to help us consider how your COVID-19 social experiences could be very different based on the color of your skin. Great to have you here as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. Murray Garcia, I'd like to start with you. How are COVID-19 social situations playing out in your role of teaching understanding and acceptance among the students there at the school?
Well, actually, it's been, Randall, a community experience, right? Like, so we as African-Americans in this country, are more likely to get COVID, we're more likely to be hospitalized, we're more likely to die from it. And so we know colleagues, for instance, dear friend of mine who've lost up to 6 members back east. So it is a reality, and I'm sure that's not uncommon. Connected to that, and we really cannot disconnect the tragedy and disappointment and disillusionment of the murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and just that, again, that structural racism that we have had to navigate with such adaptive genius to be as resilient a people as we have been. Then there's the issue of, just that old issue of, do we trust the medical scientists? Do we trust science that has, justified racism in the past? I think that's a huge issue for us as well.
Yeah, and that has been that, Doctor. That issue right there has been one that I'm not sure has been brought up enough. But there is a history of the medical profession not necessarily giving African Americans good information or using them as test subjects when they were unaware. And so now, fast forward to this pandemic we're in, there is at least a layer of doubt or mistrust because of that history.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say, we call it healthy suspicion, but I wouldn't say it's unfounded in this sense, because there's that history that sometimes plays out, and we know it does with folks getting different quality of care by race, no matter what their insurance is, no matter, okay? And then you have, then you watch where the testing is being done, you watch, certain populations, the only way to get a rapid test, it seems, if you're Black, as if you're a professional athlete. And then we have just things like public revenue, something like Measure U. We're supposed to come to certain communities, and all of a sudden that's being dispersed elsewhere. Just a lot of things, I think, undermine our trust in the sense that folks are trying to do our best and are not themselves even implicitly influenced by these historical patterns and the different value we place on black lives.
Mm-hmm. And then that cloaks all social interactions with everything you just described.
Well, yes. And that doesn't mean there aren't great people out there, and I'm certainly not speaking for Black people as a monolith, right? I'm just one person. But I think, this kind of perfect storm of what's going on racially and then with this incredible once in a lifetime, hopefully, pandemic. And it brings forth issues of structural inequality, like how is it in 2020 we've built a society, the wealthiest nation in the world, where if kids don't go to school, half of them may not get a meal. Half of them may not eat that day, a healthy meal. And for African Americans, that percentage goes up to 75% of our kids. So when we're asking folks to do this or that, and they're dealing with constraints like that, I have to go to work. I got to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. We disproportionately work in occupations where we are frontline providers,
right.
Even within healthcare workers, we're more likely to be LVNs and CNAs and transport folks who work very closely.
Which are types of nurses, right? LVNs and CNAs,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, licensed vocational nurses and certified nursing assistants.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Professor Sherman, you're interested in how people perceive themselves and other people and groups of people. Much of your research focuses on stereotyping and prejudice. How has COVID-19 played out in your observations?
Well, I don't know that it's qualitatively different than how those things have played out in all aspects of our society and the history of this country. It's a magnified consequences for sure. Now these are acute life and death matters rather mm-hmm. than generational or lifetime, but the same biases that we see all the time in many parts of society, you're seeing as well in COVID, with some there are always some content specific factors, like the anti-Asian bias is really spiked because of COVID, largely because we have leadership that's encouraged it. But generally, it's kind of always there. It's always in the background, and whatever is happening, it's going to affect.
When you say leadership that's encouraged it, are you referring to President Trump referring to COVID-19 using terms that would indicate that it came from China and slang along that line?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's playing out with some backlash against the Asian community that we've seen multiple reports of.
Yeah, anti-Asian prejudice, discrimination, violence has spiked, uh-huh. and this certainly isn't helping.
Dr. Murray Garcia, there was a period when there are still protests going on, Black Lives Matter protests going on, but when those protests were peaking, there was a lot of pointing fingers at the protests as being possible sources for transmission of the virus, which for the most part did not play out when they went through contact tracing. Is that part of this whole social picture in terms of what one race can do or not do and how they are considered, in the big picture, how they're considered to be part of it?
Oh, man, that's a really wonderful question. I just want folks to think about, just the perfect storm of compounding, shooting after shooting of unarmed Black men by both police and civilians. And this was a time when that was absolutely necessary. And I saw folks trying to do their best with social distancing and masks in that context. But again, pointing the finger at folks who are protesting state violence, it's just ironic, isn't it? And again, when you look at even the pictures from Michigan, right, where these white folks had automatic weapons inside state houses, demanding the head of the white governor. I think the respect was different. Yeah.
Doctor, you also mentioned to me prior to us coming on the air here that one social interaction that concerns you greatly right now is funerals. Sadly, we're seeing many funerals because of the pandemic. What are your thoughts there? What are you thinking when it comes to paying our respects to someone who's passed away during this time?
Okay, so this is a really near and dear issue to my heart, partly because I've dealt with it as a member of an extended family, trying to beg people not to have these huge funerals, not to have what we call repasts, which is the very wonderful kind of gathering together for several hours across generations. Sometimes funerals are the only things that bring us together over the miles in our lifetimes. And I'm just asking African Americans, the stakes are so much higher for us. We just can't. If you're going to have them, I think there's a lot of conflicting information. Unfortunately, I sought for an hour looking for guidelines. I think the CDC guidelines are really, here's this terrible disease, but if you're going to have them, here's what to do. So I just don't want us to lose any more people. And
you're afraid a funeral could be a trigger point for viral spread.
I think when folks are coming from miles away, I think when you know you're going to hug people, you know you're going to hug people. That is not the situation where you're not going to hug people. Even if you didn't want to, you know that person needs a hug. There are some things I think if you're going to do them, like having a service at the gravesite. So that's outside or at the crematorium. Of course, good masks, staying 6 feet away, even moving the chair so that they are 6 feet away. Mm-hmm. And I just beg people not to have a repast. Please don't do that where we're together for several hours. We're not really supposed to be out of the house, right? And get someone to video it. Spend that on a really great video and have that sharing, not the same, but have that sharing and conversation across Zoom or Facebook or whatever. I just want folks to know it's different for us. The stakes are so high, and we've lost pastors, over 30 pastors, black pastors across the nation. We know the funeral in Georgia where folks wanted to, I get it, we want to go, but then 7 people die of it.
Right.
And that's not even counting the folks who survive and have to live with these
There's also astronomically high transmission within the Latino population. Funerals, of course, a big part of the community there as well, in all of our communities. So Dr. Jan Murray Garcia is an associate clinical professor at the UC Davis Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, my.
And also professor of psychology at the UC Davis Center for Mind and Brain, Jeffrey Sherman. Thank you for your input as well.
Thanks for having me.
And that's
my
it.
Pleasure. My pleasure.
That's it for Insight for today. I'm Randall White with producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, and Helga Salinas. Chris Vera Phillips is the person at Cap Radio who tweets important Insight content each morning and other interactive aspects of the show. And this is her last week, sadly, at the station as she pursues her doctorate. Congratulations. She gets today's last minute Insight segment. So stand back, or socially distance, I should say.
The 6 feet rule is a struggle in the U.S., but for people from Saudi Arabia and Romania, it's not too far off from where their cultural personal space boundaries already exist. A study in the Journal of Cross-Cultural Psychology a few years ago shows those living in Argentina may have the toughest time with social distancing during the pandemic. Personal space there is just over a foot for close friends and 2.5 feet for strangers, the least of any country studied. In the U.S., we fall somewhere in the middle, but tend toward a shorter distance. I'm Chris Vera Phillips, and I am CAP Radio's interactive producer for mornings.
Chris Vera Phillips, best of luck at ASU. We're going to miss you as part of the team, that is for sure. Also, those social distances vary greatly depending on whether it's a close contact or whether it's like a colleague or something. Can really like move those numbers around. Our engineer is Antonio Munez, and technical director is Mark Jones. The big wigs for this show, Aram Sarkissian and Joe Barr. And of course, you, the biggest bigwig of all. Thanks for choosing Insight this morning, and hope you'll be part of the gang when we meet back here on Monday at 9. We'll see you then.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.